This is the D Word Podcast, where we talk dementia. Welcome along to another edition of the D Word Podcast. This week's guest is Kate Pilkington, who started out in social care in the US before moving to the UK, where she started River Path Care. Well, Kate, it's great for me to meet you again. Of course, we first met on a joint friend of ours, Christine Smith's broadcast, Aspects of Aging, which time I said, I've got to get Kate on the D Word. And we've finally achieved that. So welcome to the D Word. You're CEO of River Path Care Limited, which we will no doubt talk about in the fullness of time. But first of all, I mean, can you just tell us your story a little bit about how you got into, you know, the whole care industry, which started for you as a teenager, didn't it?
It did indeed. Yes. Thank you very much, Pete. I was about 14 years old, and my mom was a private aide in a nursing home. And so after school, I used to go up and visit with her, and I used to hang out in the nursing home. And because I'm old, way back when, they used to let you do a lot more things in nursing homes than they do now. So I used to hand out food and, you know, used to help groom and put on makeup and paint fingernails and to feed them, learned how to rise, really learned how to do a lot of the care that you're not really allowed to do anymore these days. But I really enjoyed being with the older generation. I learned a whole lot from them, and I think they enjoyed being around some of my youth and inexperience because I was just happy to be there. So that's how it all started. And then I went to university and I found social work. So that was the next step in my journey. And when I finished and graduated from university, I ended up working in the same nursing home that I used to volunteer in all those years before and became their social worker. So that's kind of how my path started in care. What I found out was I was very good at the business development side of things. So my career path has taken me on the state side as a social worker. Then it was business development, where my niche was in building different types of care. What's the word I'm looking for? I used to build different programs for different types of vulnerable people. So I built one for adults with developmental disabilities, so they could bypass the hospitals and come directly to our hospital, where we had a specialized program for them. So when they weren't doing well in the community, instead of creating a big problem within the emergency rooms, where the emergency rooms didn't know what to do with them, and then they send them right back to their provider, we actually had a program. So we worked with all the local providers, and they told us what was needed. And so we would help support them on the hospital side. Also, always continued to work with the with elders in some way, shape, or form. So built a program that was specialized to help people in nursing homes. A lot of times it's difficult to get care into a nursing home. So if it's either a specialized test, you have to go to the hospital for that. So we created a transportation program. And then also, I think we called it a senior clinic, where I would have specialists that would come in, and we would bring the people from the nursing home directly into our program. So if it was a test they needed, or if they needed to see a special doctor, the doctor would either come to us, or we would take the resident to that individual so that they could get the care they needed. Because the last thing you want to do is have somebody elderly, whether they're ambulatory or not, wandering around being lost in a hospital. So we provided all that additional support and care for them, made sure that they had food, water. We changed them if necessary, and then we'd make sure that they would get from point A to point B safely and then back to the nursing home. So that's kind of how my career path started. And then I had a personal tragedy and decided that I needed to make some changes in my life. So I moved to the UK 10 years ago. Both my parents are British, so I thought it would be a very easy transition to go from an English-speaking country to another English-speaking country. And because I understood care, I thought this would be very simple. It has not been that. So the journey has been a little challenged along the way. But I have learned a tremendous amount, and I'm on a mission now to be able to bring some of what the best of what the US has to try to integrate that into the British culture and the British care models so that we can actually enhance the model here, and make care better for people. And that this is where I feel like I have the most opportunity to be able to do that.
So when when you made that transition, you did all your learning in the US, came across to the UK. What was your first impression when you kind of began to realize what the UK care system was all about?
Yeah, it was very eye-opening, and it was very challenging for me. I had to learn the language because even though I speak English, the words mean different things. To me, rehab in the United States means very short-term care, whether that's in mental health or that's in general care as well. It's very, very short-term. Over here, a rehab hospital, and I worked for one, and they had clients that had been there for 10 years. I'm like, that's not rehab. That's housing people. So for me, it was about learning the language, understanding the differences in the models of care, and how they were delivered. The states deinstitutionalized years ago. So, and what I find here is that, especially for the mental health perspective, once you're in that system, it's very difficult to get out of the system. And so, the way that the model is created here, you actually end up institutionalizing people instead of helping them get back to the community. So, from that perspective, that was a very different way of understanding how care was delivered. I've worked with all sorts of different populations. I've worked in primary care. I've worked in the health and care sector. So all of those different sectors, every bit of that care is delivered differently. And so for me, what I thought would be an easy transition has turned out to be much of a learning curve in how things are delivered. And then it's not even a matter of being able to go in and just do things the way I think they should be done, because you have to work within the social care model over here as well. But there are little things that I can do that can change those models, and that's what I'm on a mission to be able to do. Language is the other thing that I had to learn. Even though I speak English, it's a different English, and sometimes those words mean different things. And even though I think I'm saying something very polite, sometimes it gets translated and it's not very polite over here. So I've had to learn all of that and then also incorporate that.
The station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Got some great guests lined up over the next few weeks, but there's plenty of room for more here on the podcast. So if you've got a story to tell and would like to join me, then do get in touch. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky, and the email address is tdwradio@gmail.com. My guest this week is Kate Pilkington, who found a number of differences between the care systems in the US and the UK, particularly in terms of language and culture.
To work with all of the caregivers in this country and make sure that they understand the language and they also understand culturally how the British wish to be taken care of. And so we spend a tremendous amount of time at Riverpath in order to make sure that our staff are integrated. I know some of the faux pas that I've made along the way, and if I can stop that happening from some of our, with some of our caregivers, then I've hopefully managed to create a better care quality for not just the caregiver, but also the experience for the person receiving that care. because I think in a lot of cases, it's not necessarily that they're discriminatory or that they, don't want somebody from a different culture caring for them. I think sometimes it's just the cultural barriers, and sometimes it's the language that's utilized, and it's there's a disconnect there. So it's really important that we integrate those that are not from here and teach them about the British culture so that they can be successful in their caregiving, because there's a lot of really brilliant people out there, very kind-hearted people who want to do a good job, but they have to understand what the culture expects. So that's part of what I've had to learn along this journey.
And I guess one of the other areas is the budget model that we've got here, in the fact that, funding is split between the NHS and local authorities. And it always seems to me, I kind of look on the outside of all this and think, well, really, we should just have one big bowl of money, because social care and the NHS should be the same thing, but they're not. And, for someone like me, that's frustrating. So for you to come into that world, that must have been frustrating as well.
It is. It's taken a long time to actually understand how the funding works and who's paying for what. And I think that's part of where the system is actually broken today, because social care can provide so much more to support the NHS. And when you keep throwing money at the NHS without looking at the social care sector, then you're doing everybody a massive disservice. Because if we From the social care perspective, if we're working on a preventative model where we're out there educating up our staff to be able to help spot some disease progression or strokes, whatever it may be that's very time sensitive, sepsis, then if we can catch that quickly and get them the help that they need, then hopefully we can stop something from becoming worse for the client when they receive the care that they need. It stops, it blocks beds. This is the other piece with social care. There should be an option for everybody to be able to choose the provider that they want to work with. And not all providers are created equal in the types of services that they provide. And so it's important that the person receiving care works with the best company for them, not those that are on the framework per se, or, because some of the frameworks are closed off, so there isn't an opportunity. And when you're that closed off, then it's hard to progress, and it's hard, there's no reason for anybody to have to come up with better ways to care for people. So the actual care side of things doesn't actually progress anywhere because there's no incentive. Where the American model, whether you agree with it or not, it's all about, because it's all private, you have to be better than somebody else, because everybody has a choice on who they use. And if you're not providing the best possible care and you're not connecting with people, then they will change providers and you don't get paid. So it is it, there, there's so much more that we could do with the system over here to be able to provide better care and funding. You're absolutely right. If it was one big pot of money, and they understood that social care can actually prevent and or help the NHS so that there aren't bed blockages, if we start care immediately with a plan to discharge somebody out into the community and we hook them up with providers up front, then it should be a very seamless, easy process. So admission, discharge, and if they already have somebody that they're working with, then let them continue with that care, because every time you interrupt somebody, no matter how good a new company may be, it's going to take them time to get to know that individual. And if they have dementia or if they're elderly, they don't adapt well to new people coming in. They already had a system. They knew what they were doing. And for us, it's about providing that continuity. It's having the same caregivers day in and day out. It's about understanding that person, providing that person-centered care. And when you can do that, and then hopefully then you can either prevent a hospitalization, or there's already a plan to get somebody out of the hospital much quicker, and their recovery time is much better once they get home, instead of changing providers or deciding, well, that provider's not on our framework, so they're entitled to reablement, and then, but you're not part of the reablement. Well, who cares? We know the client. Let us continue to take care of them, you know, because from my perspective, they're just throwing away money, and they're prolonging and making somebody not progress as well. So instead of reabling somebody, we're disabling people, because our system is broken over here. So I absolutely agree with what you have to say.
I guess another aspect is our use of technology, or possibly in the way I see it, our not use of technology. I'm very
Yes.
frustrated by the fact that if, for example, if you buy a vacuum cleaner off a certain online shop, then suddenly on your Facebook page will be an advert related to something you've just bought. And I'm a really simple
Yes.
guy. I sit here and think, if they can do that, why on earth can our health services not utilize technology in the same way?
Absolutely, absolutely. I find the same thing, and it is very frustrating. The US digitized many years ago, where I think Britain was supposed to have already done it, but it's still not there. And a lot of the systems are very broken. So when I entered into the marketplace here, that was one of the things that I invested very heavily in because I didn't like the systems either. I didn't think that they were good enough. They didn't do what they needed to do. It wasn't producing person-centered care. It was creating more problems than it was if you just did it by paper, because now all we're doing is cutting and pasting into the new systems. So I've been working for the last 10 years with another company, and that's what we've been focused on, is really creating some amazing technology that integrates in with all of the systems. So it's finished for hospitals, it's finished for supportive living, and we're just in the process of getting it's live and ready to go for the home care system. So it's set up for all the everything to be able to do. It's set up so that everything can be done all in one system. It's interactive. So one of the biggest problems that we have with technology is that it's only as good as the information that you put in, but most of it doesn't allow for family to contribute. It doesn't allow, if you're working in the community sector, it doesn't allow for other organizations, so district nurses, the GP, CQC. It doesn't allow for anybody else to be able to integrate into that. Our system that we've created allows for everybody to have that input. And so we're still working around some of the privacy issues that come along with all of that, because GDPR is obviously a really big thing, but it's also about you as an individual having access to your information and being allowed to give that information to other individuals so that you can actually have a big bird's eye view of what that individual looks like, so you can provide all of the care that's necessary. Because when you're working in silos, everyone has a little bit of knowledge and information, but nobody has the big picture. And so that's something that we've been working really hard on to be able to try to change in this country and make it person-centered care. Because I think what's happened is people, most companies and care within the NHS and everywhere else, we've become a tick box exercise. So it's about how fast, how many people can you see? But we've forgotten that the people we're treating are human beings. And for me, it's really important to get back to that human element of taking care of people and having an experience, because when you have a good experience, you tend to think that that's better care. So you equate a good experience with quality, where when you walk into some of the clinics that I've been into personally, that I've been into, it's pretty horrifying. And if I'm horrified at some of the care that I'm receiving, then everybody else should be horrified as well. And I don't know that they are. So I think it's expectation as well is part of the problem. This is the way it's always been done. So why would we do it any differently? It's efficient. It may be efficient in some respects, but it's not giving you dignified care. And so it makes you feel, as a human being, it makes you feel like you're just a number to somebody else, that you're not important to anybody. And I don't want to have a service like that, because I know how it made me feel when I went in for a test recently. And it wasn't great. And then they're at the very end, they're saying, okay, they come out and they call your name and they're saying, okay, you can go or you can go. No, you have to stay. So if you're one of the people that now has to stay, for me, that's going against confidentiality as well. It's not even efficient from my perspective. And, you know, again, I had to carry my clothes around.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
On UK Health Radio, there are nearly 50 weekly shows covering all aspects of health, available for listen again and download from the website at www.ukhealthradio.com. I'm chatting on this edition to Kate Pilkington from River Bath Care. Going on from what you were saying, and part of it was, you know, we've always done it that way, which is a kind of sometimes a British mindset. One of the things I saw on your website was involving people living with dementia in staff training.
Yes.
I consider myself
yes.
having an overview. I'm not involved in all the lists. I look from the outside. And my first view of that was, well, doesn't everybody do that? Isn't that obvious? And yet they don't, do they?
No, they don't. It's not obvious to most people. I would think that it would be obvious. What's really interesting is that even my staff, when I say I'm bringing in someone so that you can meet them, so you can see a different perspective and hear from somebody who has dementia, their perspective on what dignified care looks like. At the end of that, what's absolutely amazing is that the staff's perception, they're like, well, how is somebody with dementia going to teach us? And when you finish that conversation, the staff come back and say, we had no idea. We wouldn't have known that person had dementia. And so I think it's about ideas and stigma, what they've already been taught, what they've been, you know, what they think dementia looks like. And without putting real people to different stages and phases of what dementia looks like, I don't know how else to put that empathetic piece back into the training. Because when you're most people, when they train, they talk about dementia, what's the best way to care for somebody, let's talk about the behaviors, but you're not getting. Whilst they may teach you about the different types of dementia, until you meet somebody that has it, it doesn't really connect. It's just textbook reading. So I think it's a brilliant thing that we do. We're also meeting with people who are victims of stroke and other types of disabilities so that they can share their own experience of what it's been like to either be cared for in their process, so that, again, our caregivers can see this is the type of, these are real people. They have real feelings and they expect to be treated in a certain way. And so regardless of where you come from, you would want the same type of care provided for you. So let's let people live life on their own terms. And I think that training is absolutely invaluable. And I think everybody should provide that type of training.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. Listeners probably know a couple of years ago I had a cancer diagnosis and I'm fine, everything's going fine. But you do actually realise then that you're suddenly the man with the big C over the top of your head. And I talk to my friends living with dementia and they feel, first of all, they are X name with dementia. And suddenly, for some reason, they've had a diagnosis and they've become a completely different person, which is, you know, to my knowledge, what I went through, it's just not the case.
Absolutely. It's. I think once you get a label for anything, you start to become that label. And it's not. It doesn't, shouldn't define you. You are that person who happens to have that diagnosis. And so how do we allow you to still be a human being and still have the type of care that you need, that support. We may have to do things differently, but it doesn't mean that you have become a complete invalid without thoughts and feelings. You know, you need to be able to share how you feel and how you want things done. You know, if you've been fastidious your entire life and there are certain things that you like to have things done in a certain way, then there's no reason why we can't continue some of that, if the type of care that you need continues to allow for that. Or we might have to find a different way, but it also has to be agreed by you. So yeah, you don't have to become your diagnosis, but a lot of times people, I think especially in the British culture, they take on that label and they think, oh. And that's, I think, what happens in the mental health world as well. It's all of a sudden, well, you have a mental health, you need to be locked up in a hospital. And so if you work hard, then maybe you can get back into the community. Well, why would you? You have your meals covered, and so you learn how to become disabled, or you learn how to become mentally ill. And so instead of trying to find new ways to move forward and a new purpose in your life, then you become a diagnosis. And then you fall victim to some of those labels, and you fall victim to, to whatever it is that's not the good side of things. That's what you become, because you don't think that there's a way forward. So yeah, you're absolutely right. I agree with you.
Yeah, and in having this conversation with you, I think the way I think common sense is something that is completely undervalued, because a lot of the stuff you've been talking about and you've been saying to me is total common sense. But for some reason, and I don't know whether that applies in the US or in other countries, but here in the UK, we seem to lose sight of just what I would consider as, well, my dad was he's an old Londoner. He used to call it a bit of common. And I think we lose sight of that.
We do. I've always said common sense does not grow in every garden, and I don't think that matters if it's a US garden or if it's a UK garden. Yeah, things that seem very obvious. People are lazy, I think, sometimes in general. And if they don't have to think about something, or if it doesn't affect them directly, they're not gonna look for new ways necessarily to improve things, or a different way for anything. So yes, c common sense. I would love for everybody who comes to me to have some common sense, and to also be able to have a little bit of initiative. But that is the one thing that I do find to be quite different between the US mindset and the UK mindset, and that is taking that initiative. In the States, you're expected to initiate, because you have to be better than somebody else. And as I mentioned earlier, it's not always, there's no incentive necessarily for some of the organizations to progress or think about better ways to do things. And unless it affects you directly, then why would you think about different ways to make something better? So it's only when it comes directly to you that most people go, oh, maybe there is a better way. But culturally, over here as well, I do find that it's not as progressive as the States either. So even if it does affect you, again, it's about the mentality. Americans tend to see obstacles as opportunities, and so they'll do something about it. I like to call them gifts. When there's a complaint, when something doesn't go right, I call that a gift, and then try to find a different way to improve something. Where over here, I feel like they just like to talk about it. They want to talk about it, complain about it until and beat it to death. And then they just give up. Or they come up with something, or they want to take a long process for everybody to participate. But by the time they all come together and agree on something, it's 10 years later and nothing has really progressed. That's not everybody. And that's not the entire British population, because there are some very innovative people in this country. They just happen to be in little pockets. And so as soon as those people find one another, then you start to get some momentum and you're able to move things forward. But sometimes it's hard to find those pockets of people who really want to make a difference and look at things in a different perspective.
Yeah, that's what we'd like to do on the show here, and hopefully that we do that. Time is sadly bringing us a bit of a close. I saw your website. I spend most of my time trying to keep my dog out of the show, but I just wanted to ask you about Flex and Albie, who are your two assistance dogs.
Yeah, they're actually upstairs. I put them in a different room just so they wouldn't bark today. But I'm a big fan of animals and believe that animals have a special place within healthcare and within people's lives. I'd say probably the majority of people have had animals at some point in their lives. Not everybody, but these guys are specially trained, and that I take them out with me. So for people who have lost their If they've lost their pets or they need a little bit of therapy, they're a little bit lonely, then as far as I know, I'm one of the few home care companies that actually go out and visit with, as a CEO, I go out and visit with my clients. And if they're interested, then I will take Flex and or Albie with me so that they can have a little bit of animal love as well. Because I think that normalizes things for people. Whether you're living at home or in a nursing home or wherever it is that you have to go to receive care, I do believe that animals' nature are so incredibly important. And I'll be in to spread a little love, spread a little joy. Yeah, and that's Flex and Ollie. They're just lovely little dogs.
Well, Kate, it's been a pleasure. Benny the Cockapoo sends his regards to Flex and Albie. And thank you so much for being my
You
guest.
very
And
much.
I know we will keep in touch, and hopefully we can do this again sometime in the future and see how things are going.
Oh, that would be fantastic, Pete. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, and I wish you a very happy holidays and a happy new year.